First, we want to take a look at the company closures in terms of the numbers and how many have closed, 57,000. The reasons for the closures, inflation, 4%. Deflation, can't calculate that because it goes into negative territory. Hasn't happened yet. You have the army drafts that are 350 to 400,000. And also the Gaza border evacuations, 700,000. I must say that that's an artificial border that has been placed on the Gaza Strip based on the settlements. Next up, we go to job losses that have occurred. Full-time job losses, 256,000 since the war started. Then you have the temporary workers. They were laid off, 80,000. You have the ones that are now on the assistance by the budget of Israel, 160,000 of them, out of a job. And altogether, 1.3 million in terms of the workforce. That's 30% of it that are not part of the economy. Next up, we go to per capita income, $54,660 for 2022. Now, this figure has dropped for the year 2023, mainly because of the war now, down to $46,461. That's a 15% decrease. The impacts that this have are many, in which this circle is going to point to it because of the war has affected every Israeli. Standards of living, unemployment, inflation, inequality, all a consequence of this war. So you can see how that is detrimental and how Israel is suffering. Next up, we go to the insurance premiums, non-Israeli vessels, 100%. These are for the shipping, and of course you know that the Yemeni army is targeting the vessels. 250% for Israeli vessels is what the premium has gone up to. Local markets, competitiveness, and imported raw materials all have been affected because of the war, in particular by the Yemeni army targeting Israeli-linked vessels. The all-important tech sector, the investment down 50%. That's a lot. That contributes almost 20% of the Israeli economy. Number of deals down 38%. Again, another big figure. And then you have staff shortages in terms of the employees. They've been called for duty, one of the reasons. But it has reduced the staff by 10 to 15%. Now, the GDP growth, the impact that it has had. Let's look at this before the war, what it was, which is 3.1% for Q1 through 3, and then for Q4, it's down to 2.4%, okay? So the pivotal and key impact that this has had on Israel and its economy. Well, let's find out what our guests think that's more important about all of this. Let me bring them back. We have Wafik Faor, Vermonters for Justice in Palestine, who rejoins us. Wafik, welcome back to Economic Divide. You know, the war cost is pretty incredible in terms of the numbers, anywhere from $250 to $260 million daily for Israel. On the other hand, of course, the economy is losing money. As a result, you have capital flight to add to that. You have mass exodus of people out of Israel. And given Israel's uncertainty when it comes to its economic standing, how can Israel ever regain or try to recoup the losses and even stay afloat, based on some accounts?
There is we have to rethink what Israel now, post October 7. We cannot rethink it that it will regain what they lose on this war. The war in Gaza, it changed all this calculus. Number one, there is opposite or reverse migration from Israel. We heard at least over a quarter of a million of Israeli who carry second passports, they already left Israel. We know that the cheap migrants that they are coming from Thailand, India, and others are leaving Israel. And their farms has no workers and no laborers to continue. Their factories are out of work, and their hotels are closed, no tourism, etc. I don't believe it will repair itself on a short term or long term.
All right. We heard about, obviously, the staff and the number of employees to be the focus of the comments made there by our guest. But there's a more important issue that needs to be dealt with here. I want to ask that from our guest who rejoins us, Alice Rothschild, author and filmmaker. Alice Rothschild, welcome back to the program. I think it's a proper time to address what needs to be addressed. I think it's something that's somewhat maybe forgotten in between the awful and shocking scenes that are coming out of the Gaza Strip, and that is how to deal with this and the root cause of it to be tackled. What do you think? Is that being discussed enough, and how should that be addressed?
Right. So the root causes of this crisis are the ongoing occupation of the occupied territories and the siege of Gaza. It is not a reasonable expectation by Israel and the Israeli government and military to think that you can suppress and oppress a group of people endlessly, and that that somehow keeps Israeli citizens safe. Ultimately, oppressed people will react and try to fight back their oppressive situation. So unless that oppression, the siege, the occupation, the second-class citizenship of Palestinians in Israel, unless the refugees are addressed, then this conflict will never resolve.
The Israeli regime's central bank says the shortage in workers is costing the economy a staggering $600 million a week. The cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is also spending millions to pay reservists salaries and to compensate businesses that were affected by the U.S.-Israeli onslaught, which is also putting a strain on the budget. There are direct and indirect costs of Israel's genocidal war also. The direct expenses refer to the hot cash losses the regime incurs every day, leading the cabinet to seek $6 billion in loans with a high and unusual interest rate to fund its aggression. This includes, but is not limited to, the daily cost of weapons, tools, and supplies, wages and salaries of the reserve forces, and damages, depreciation, and maintenance of military machinery. As for the indirect expenses, the U.S.-Israel genocidal war has negatively affected several economic sectors, and a sharp drop of revenues in transportation in the port of Eilat has badly affected the regime's economy. The question is, with capital flight and mass exodus out of Israel, and given Israel's uncertainty and instability in occupied Palestine altogether, how can Israel hope to regain its economic strength?
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Matti Apossian. In the in-depth section, Kaveh covered some instances of how the Israeli economy is suffering. The Israeli onslaught has created major financial and economic headaches for Israel in more ways than one. There doesn't seem to be a way to figure out how much money is needed to continue with this genocidal war when it comes to the budget. This has led to the entire revision of the 2023-2024 budget. So, what are the discrepancies? The direct cost of the genocidal war on the Israeli economy, according to the regime's finance minister, was announced to be $245 million daily. But the Bank of Israel disagreed. It said onslaught would cost $269 million per day and is poised to take a bigger toll on the regime's economy than previous conflicts. Here are some other figures which were below the actual expenditure of this genocidal war. $6.25 billion, the expected cost of military operations for 60 days, which included ammunition, equipment, and mobilizing reserves. $4.25 billion, the expected cost of health and financial compensations for individuals and companies affected by the war. $6.9 billion, the expected loss to the public finance due to the decline in tax revenues lost. Some economic sectors, such as the restaurant industry, have declared tax disobedience due to their suspension of operations. The figures just did not add up. They were either a lot higher or lower in some cases, like when it comes to the Israeli economic losses. The Israeli economy's losses due to the onslaught was $17.2 billion. This included economic material damages, operations costs, and the additional deficit. According to the budget, the total expenditure for the needs of the war in 2023 should be around $8 billion, $4.7 billion for the military, and about $3.32 billion for civil and other expenses. But the total cost of the genocidal war now came in at a much higher price tag, $41 billion to $50 billion, equal to up to around 10% of gross domestic product. This was based on the genocidal war to last between 8 to 12 months. Budget and cost inconsistencies were predicted. The finance ministry earlier had warned that Israel's onslaught will likely exceed estimates 2.3% of gross domestic product in 2023 and 3.5% in 2024. That does it for this edition of the Quick Take section.
The U.S.-Israeli genocidal war is costing Israel a lot. The regime forces are being taken out by the resistance fighters, and obviously that is not good news for Israel, who wanted to, had the goal of eradicating Hamas and the resistance fighters. That's not happening. Meanwhile, Israel has lost its economic standing, and one country after another are either adopting more boycott measures or they're turning sour on Israel overall. Diplomatically also having an impact. Post-Israeli onslaught is where this is going to be the focus. But what kind of a post-onslaught will there be for Israel? And even the U.S., for that matter, they have both come down based on the genocide that they've executed in the Gaza Strip. And last but not least, Yemen's targeting of Israeli-linked vessels. Will that stop the genocidal war? That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for being with us. We've really enjoyed it. I'm Kavitah Lee, and it's goodbye from the entire team here at Economic Divide.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
A recent survey has revealed U.S. President Joe Biden's support has collapsed among young Americans, with 68% of those under the age of 30 saying he should not run again for president in 2024. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Newsweek magazine has covered the story and tells us more. According to polling data, President Joe Biden's current approval rating is lower than that of the last four presidents who failed to win a second term in office. Joe Biden's popularity among voters has been a major talking point in the 2024 campaign. His approval ratings, percentage-wise, has steadily been in the low 40s for most of his presidency. According to poll aggregator 538, it was at its highest point when Joe Biden first took office in January of 2021 at 53.1% and at its lowest point in July of 2022 at 38.2%. A recent opinion poll conducted by American Research Group from 17th to 20th of December found that 37% of Americans approve of Joe Biden's handling of his presidency, while 57% disapprove. The opinion poll surveyed 1,100 adults living in the continental United States and had a margin of error of 3 percentage points. Looking at how Biden's popularity fares compared to past incumbents who lost their re-election campaigns, he has a lower approval rating than Donald Trump, George H.W. Bush, Jimmy Carter, and Gerald Ford at the same point in their presidencies. On the 1,074th day of Donald Trump's presidency, he had a 42.5% approval rating, compared to Joe Biden's 39.3%. Donald Trump later lost the 2020 election to Joe Biden. There will likely be a rematch between Trump and Biden in 2024, as Biden is a Democratic incumbent and Donald Trump is the current frontrunner for the Republican nomination. Former Republican President George H.W. Bush had a 51.8% approval rating on his 1,074th day in office, which is 12.5 percentage points ahead of Joe Biden at the same point in his presidency. George W. Bush then lost the 1992 election to Bill Clinton, a Democrat. Biden's approval rating is about 10 percentage points behind former Democratic President Jimmy Carter's at this point in their presidencies. On the 1,074th day of the Carter administration, President Jimmy Carter had a 49.2% approval rating. Carter lost to Republican candidate Ronald Reagan in the 1980 presidential election. Former Republican President Gerald Ford lost the 1976 election to Jimmy Carter, but his circumstances were different. Gerald Ford, former President Richard Nixon's vice president, took office in 1974 after Richard Nixon resigned following the Watergate scandal. Gerald Ford was only president for 895 days. On his 855th day in office, he had an approval rating of 44.5%. On Joe Biden's 855th day in office, he had an approval rating of 41%. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered this story and tells us more. A recent opinion poll shows 6 in 10 voters, including nearly one-third of Democrats, say Joe Biden should not run for president in 2024. Also, in a further alarming sign for Joe Biden, almost half of Democrats say it is not too late for the 81-year-old to be replaced as their party's nominee. The extensive survey conducted jointly by the Daily Mail and JL Partners poll showed 60% of the American public think Joe Biden should not seek re-election, with only 34% saying he should, and 6% expressing no opinion. Perhaps the most troubling revelation for the White House will be that even 29% of Democrats said Joe Biden should not run for president again. The latest set of alarming results for the Biden administration come less than 24 hours after a Daily Mail opinion poll revealed former President Donald Trump is ahead by 4 percentage points nationwide. The opinion poll revealed results for male and female voters were virtually identical. It showed Joe Biden's support has collapsed among young American voters, with 68% of those under the age of 30 saying he should not run again, the most of any age group. In every age group, over 50% of voters thought he should drop out of the race. Majorities of both college graduates and non-graduates also agreed. There were signs of Biden losing support in his Democrat base, with 59% of Hispanic voters and 49% of black voters saying he should not be the Democratic Party's nominee. And there were further worrying signs for the president, with 65% of independent voters saying he should not run again, with only 26% believing that he should. Winning over independents will be crucial if Joe Biden is to defeat the likely Republican nominee Donald Trump in 2024. The opinion poll showed more Democrats believe it is not too late to ditch Joe Biden than those who think the time has passed. It revealed 44% of Democrats think it is not too late, while 42% say it is too late. Among independents, 66% thought it was not too late to replace Joe Biden, and 71% of Republicans agreed. Majorities of white, Hispanic, and black voters all agreed it was not too late to find another Democratic nominee. Scarlett McGuire, director of JL Partners pollster, said voters continue to have serious doubts about Joe Biden's ability to mount another presidential campaign, while an astonishing 6 in 10 say that Joe Biden should not run for the Oval Office again, including 1 in 3 Democrats, she added. She added, there are clear concerns about the president's age and his time in office. Fox News Channel has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a new national public opinion survey, only one-third of Americans gave President Joe Biden a thumbs up on the job approval rating he's doing in the White House. The president stands at 34% approval in a Monmouth University opinion poll released recently, with 61% giving Joe Biden a thumbs down on his job performance. The president's approval is at an all-time low in Monmouth University polling since Joe Biden took over the White House nearly 3 years ago. Americans questioned in the survey gave the president particularly low marks for his handling of immigration, 26%, and his handling of inflation, 28%. Patrick Murray, director of the Monmouth University Polling Institute, highlighted the Biden administration keeps touting their infrastructure investments and a host of so-called positive economic indicators. But most Americans are still smarting from higher prices caused by post-pandemic inflation. This seems to be what's driving public opinion. Patrick Murray spotlighted that there is certainly an element of partisanship in how people frame their own financial situation, which is based in part on who occupies the White House. But even a good chunk of Biden's Democratic base wish that he'd start paying more attention to their top priorities than he is now.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The World Health Organization has once again sounded the alarm on deepening humanitarian and medical crisis in war-torn Gaza. It has called on the international community to take urgent steps to alleviate the grave peril facing Palestinians in the besieged territory. According to the latest WHO assessments, Gaza has 13 partially functioning hospitals, 2 minimally functioning ones, and 21 that are not functioning at all.
There are actually no functional hospitals left in the north. Al-Ahli was the last one, but is now minimal functioning. And still treating patients but not admitting new ones, along with Al-Shifa, Al-Ada, and Al-Sahaba Hospital. So these hospitals are still sheltering also thousands of displaced people. At Al-Ahli, about 10 staff, all junior doctors and nurses, continue to provide basic first aid, pain management as much as possible, wound care, and trauma stabilization services.
The Nasser Medical Complex, which is the most important referral hospital in southern Gaza, is partially functioning. The World Body has expressed concern about reports of residential areas being ordered to evacuate around the hospital, which are extremely concerning. According to WHO reports and eyewitness accounts, when military activities intensify near the hospital, ambulances, patients, staff, and WHO and partners are unable to reach the complex. The World Body has also said that it is working to strengthen and expand the existing struggling health system.
WHO will keep striving to supply health facilities in the northern Gaza, but without fuel, staff, and other essential needs, medicines, medicines won't make a difference, and all patients will die slowly and painfully.
It has also expressed concern about the fresh wave of displacement of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, who have been pushed by Israel to move to further south. It says the displacement of people will further strain health facilities in the south, which are already struggling to meet the population's immense needs. The WHO statement read, "This forced mass movement of people will also lead to more overcrowding, increased risk of infectious diseases, and make it even harder to deliver humanitarian aid. Most of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are grappling with terrible injuries, acute hunger, and severe risk of disease." WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom has also repeated a call on the international community to, quote, take urgent steps to alleviate the grave peril facing the population of Gaza. The remarks come a day after the WHO staff went on a high-risk mission to deliver humanitarian supplies to the Al-Shifa Hospital in northern Gaza and Al-Amal Palestine Red Crescent Society in southern Gaza. Both hospitals serve as shelters for displaced Palestinians seeking safety amid relentless Israeli bombardment. At Al-Shifa Hospital, a reported 50,000 people are sheltering, while 14,000 others are at Al-Amal.
Seen children, women, young men, old men and women, people bleeding out. I, at the same time yesterday at Al-Aqsa, I saw a woman who had multiple gunshot wounds. An attempt was made to refer her, and she was referred back because she was bleeding so heavily. So, I mean, there's blood everywhere in these hospitals at the moment. We're seeing almost only trauma cases come through the door, and at a scale that's quite difficult to believe. It's a bloodbath, as we said before. It's carnage.
They have been injured and have been in the hospital for 10 days. As soon as the Israeli troops withdrew, I rushed to take them. As you can see, they suffer from total burns for no reason. They were left with no food or water and no care. There are other injured members of my family, but I wasn't able to carry them. After I arrived at the hospital, I witnessed massive destruction, an indescribable scene. Patients are scattered in every corner, beds are overturned, and medical material are damaged.
Comments come as Israel is pressing ahead with its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. From corpses lying unattended on the streets, to hospitals and schools reduced to rubble, to children made orphans and tens of thousands of people rendered homeless, the gory events unfolding in the besieged Gaza Strip since October 7 are a textbook example of genocide and ethnic cleansing. The death toll in the coastal territory since the Israeli regime launched its indiscriminate aerial and ground attacks nearly 3 months ago is now over 21,000, most of them children and women. Almost all refugee camps have been rendered uninhabitable due to random strikes, forcing the majority of the population to sleep under the open sky amid heavy winds and heavy downpours. The barbaric attacks were only meant to give an image of victory to its defeated army, which has only succeeded in killing unarmed civilians and destroying civilian facilities.
This is really the worst thing that U.S. and Israel could do to Palestinians. The genocide is the heinous war crimes are gone unnoticed.
The Zionist Israeli entity intensified its aggression on Gaza while keeping one eye on Hezbollah in Lebanon and the other on the West Bank, primarily due to its strategic proximity. Neither the entity nor the United States of America foresaw that Yemen, which has been at war for years without a practical resolution, would turn into a new front. In November, the Yemeni armed forces declared war on the Zionist entity in support of the resistance in Gaza, presenting a significant and unwelcome surprise for the entity. Yemen initiated missile and drone attacks on targets in the Zionist Israeli port of Eilat, overlooking the Red Sea. However, the Yemeni armed forces did not stop there and announced the imposition of what could be described as a naval blockade on the entity. It appears that there are significant losses due to the Yemeni missiles, prompting the Pentagon in the first week of December to announce a plan to form a naval force to so-called protect international navigation in the Bab el-Mandeb Strait and the Red Sea. However, despite the availability of European countries' warships and frigates, they do not express great enthusiasm to join this force. Well, that is mainly due to the fact that European countries do not possess a large naval fleet. Warships are distributed between protecting the coasts of these countries and positioning near Ukraine in anticipation of any developments in the Russian-Ukrainian war. On the other hand, these countries are concerned that if they participate in confronting the Yemeni armed forces in their Gaza support operations, their commercial ships passing through the Bab el-Mandeb and the Red Sea could themselves become targets for the Yemenis. In the meantime, despite the Pentagon's threat to respond to the Yemenis, the Yemeni armed forces daily reaffirm their determination to continue targeting Israeli entity ships and ships bound towards occupied Palestine until the Zionist entity ends the genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The matter is no longer limited to imposing a blockade on Zionist Israeli ports. The geostrategic battle and its escalating events are shaking the world. The closure of the Red Sea to ships colluding with the enemy turns into a heroic festival, teaching the U.S. and Zionist Israel harsh lessons and threatening them with more successive blows capable of breaking their alliances and coercive global policies. These strikes establish a new stage of resistance given the expansion of its military operations and the development of its capabilities to combat malicious international hegemony. There is a clear evolution in the history of resistance post October 7 and after the introduction of the equation of the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman.
Christians and Christianity are under attack in Gaza and Palestine more generally. Zionist ideology is not just anti-Muslim, it is anti-Christian too. What is the common factor that links Muslims and Christians in Palestine? They're Palestinian. So it's no surprise that the Zionists are making sure to destroy churches as well as mosques. On October the 19th, Israel bombed the Church of St. Porphyrius, Gaza's oldest, killing at least 18 people. The church is said to be the third oldest Christian church in the world, with the current building having been constructed by the Crusaders in the 1150s or 1160s. A church was built on the site as early as 425 AD. 2 days earlier, an explosion at Al-Ahli Arab Hospital, an Anglican institution located a few blocks away, killed and injured hundreds, according to Palestinian health authorities. The evidence is beginning to mount that the attacks on specifically Christian targets are themselves a specific genocide contained within the larger genocide aimed at Muslims and indeed all Palestinians. On December 16th, the Zionists directly targeted a Christian convent. An Israeli army sniper assassinated two Christian women, Nahed and her daughter Samar, inside the parish of the Holy Family in Gaza on Saturday, said the Latin Patriarchate's media office. One of the women fell while trying to rescue the other. Seven others were injured while attempting to help. Gunfire was directed at them inside the walls of the monastery, and there was no resistance in the area, it added. An Israeli artillery vehicle also targeted the Monastery of the Sisters of Mother Teresa in Gaza City, which shelters more than 54 disabled individuals within the church walls. The Zionist attack also destroyed the fuel tank, the power generator, and the solar panels, in addition to extensive damage that rendered the place unsuitable for habitation or providing care for people with disabilities. On January the 26th this year, a mob of Israeli settlers attacked an Armenian bar in the Christian quarter of the Old City of Jerusalem, shouting, "Death to Arabs, death to Christians." At the beginning of October, a video emerged of ultra-Orthodox settlers in Al-Quds spitting on Christian pilgrims. Armed and violent settlers are also in the process of attempting to liquidate the Armenian quarter in Al-Quds, and with it, the wider Christian presence, which has been there continuously since the 4th century. Only 800 to 1,000 Christians are believed to still live in Gaza, constituting the oldest Christian community in the world, dating back to the 1st century.
This year, Christmas celebrations are cancelled in Bethlehem, and for obvious reasons. It's impossible to celebrate while our people in Gaza are going through a genocide.
It's no wonder the church in Palestine has cancelled Christmas.
Hunger has become the most pressing of the myriad problems facing hundreds of thousands of displaced Gaza Palestinians, with aid trucks able to bring in only a small fraction of what is needed, and distribution uneven due to the chaos of the war. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, a Geneva-based rights group, has found that 71% of people in the Gaza Strip suffer from extreme hunger due to Israel's devastating war on the Palestinian territory and the regime's method of using starvation as a weapon. The group released the figure after it conducted an analytical study of a sample of 1,200 people in Gaza. According to the study's findings, 98% of respondents said that they eat insufficient amounts of food, while 64% of the participants admitted to eating grass, immature food, and expired materials to satiate their hunger.
All 2.2 million people are hungry, meaning that they are in crisis or worse food security situation.
More than 130,000 of Gaza's most vulnerable children, that is newborns up to 2 years of age, are not receiving the critical life-saving breastfeeding or age-appropriate complementary feeding that they absolutely require. So that's our scenario. Without sufficient safe water, food and sanitation that only a humanitarian ceasefire would bring, child deaths due to disease could well surpass those already killed in bombardments.
The study found that the rate of access to water in the Gaza Strip, including drinking, bathing and cleaning water, is 1.5 liters per person per day. This is 15 liters less than the minimum amount of water required for survival at the level required by international standards. Additionally, the study examined the effects of malnutrition and a lack of access to clean drinking water. 66% of the study sample reported having experienced diarrhea, skin rashes, or intestinal diseases in the past month. Even in Rafah, which has a crossing to Egypt through which aid trucks enter, the dearth of food and clean water is so severe, it is causing people to get ill.
The contaminated water is another issue, as the water is not 100% clean, so children and adults suffer from intestinal problems such as vomiting and diarrhea. So I ran out of antidiarrheal medications, Flagyl medicines, which is an intestinal disinfectant, and Silabrin, which is antibiotics for intestinal infections. There's a significant loss of these drugs.
Since the start of its genocide in Gaza, Israel has imposed a comprehensive blockade on the Strip and prevented supplies of food, water, fuel, and other humanitarian necessities from reaching the more than 2.3 million residents of the Strip. Israel's use of starvation as a weapon has intensified since October 7 and has included cutting off all food supplies to Gazans, as well as bombing and destroying the Strip's bakeries, factories, food stores.
We were compelled to come here as there are no bakeries available. The people here who are our friends are baking bread to aid the community. Procuring flour is challenging for us, as a 20-kilogram bag costs around 300 to 400 shekels, which is a substantial amount.
About 577,000, meaning more than half a million people, are already in catastrophic levels of hunger, meaning they're essentially starving. That is like one in every four people.
Speeches and statements from Israeli officials promoting a campaign to deliberately block access to necessary resources for the Gaza population as a strategy indicate that Israel has not made these intentions a secret. The Israeli blockade, on top of the genocidal aggression, has plunged Gaza into humanitarian catastrophe, where lack of access to sanitation and safe water has increased the prevalence of waterborne diseases. The Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court says that intentionally starving civilians by, quote, depriving them of objects indispensable to their survival, including willfully impeding relief supplies, is a war crime.
The people in the hospitals, yes, they need everything. They need medical supplies, but what they ask for first is food and water, the very basics. They do not have them. One of my colleagues described people lying on the floor in severe pain, in agony, but they weren't asking for pain relief, they were asking for water.
The plight of Gaza's 2.3 million people has become desperate amid the war. Around 80% of Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip have been displaced by the violence, while efforts to get aid into the territory have struggled. Alarmed humanitarian organizations have been calling for a ceasefire and denouncing the shocking cost of the catastrophic war, which amounts to a collective punishment of the civilian population of Gaza.
We are homeless. We can't go back to our houses. I want to see my children. I want to go back to my husband and to my house. It's unfair. It's so unfair.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with veterans from the Sacred Defense and the Resistance Field. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on September 20, 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. The magnanimous Imam Khomeini was a divine man. He was a unique, divine person who, along with his knowledge, thought, experience, and maturity in various areas, possessed a clear soul and spiritual purity. Therefore, his words were influential. For example, consider when he said, "Pave must be rescued." I heard this from the late Mustafa Chamran, who said, "As soon as Imam Khomeini's message was broadcast on the radio at 2 p.m., they were under the siege in Pave and the enemy had surrounded them. As soon as this message was broadcast, although no forces had yet arrived, and perhaps they had not even been deployed, we saw that the way had opened up around us." This message, these words were effective in themselves. I heard this from Chamran himself, our dear martyr.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Or when Imam Khomeini said, the siege on Abadan must be broken. There was no question about this. The siege was broken. In various instances, for example, in the case of Suzangard and the conflict over the attack on Suzangard, were questions about whether we should go there to defend it or not. There were problems with regard to it. When Imam Khomeini's message came via a mediator, the issue was resolved. We had a commander like him whose words were so influential and benefited from spirituality, purity, and a strong spirit. Furthermore, there was the religious color of the sacred defense, the religious color. When there is a religious color, what happens is that this young man takes action while eagerly awaiting martyrdom. Read the biographies that have been written about the martyrs. They set out with the hope of being martyred. They would cry because they wanted to go to the battlefield in the hope of becoming a martyr. This is what happens when there is a religious color. The families of these young men, their fathers, mothers, and wives would give their approval and send them to the battlefield for the cause of God. I have often visited the mothers of martyrs who, for example, had one or two children who were martyred.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Soldier who fights for his country. On the fourth anniversary of the martyrdom of top IRGC General Qasem Soleimani, we broadcast a three-part series to introduce this well-known Iranian general to a wider public. In this program, the second of this three-part series, we focus on General Qasem Soleimani's role in the Islamic Revolution of 1978-1979 and the eight-year imposed war on Iran in the 1980s. Please stay with us. The Islamic Revolution swept across Iran in 1978-1979. Everyone was talking about the revolution and its charismatic leader, Imam Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, may God bless his soul. But in the small village of Qanat Malik in Kerman province, in southern Iran, few people had access to radio or television, and thus news of what was happening in the rest of the country was rather scarce. At that time, the young Qasem Soleimani was 22 years old. He was young, enthusiastic, and a true revolutionary, and he used to distribute photographs of Imam Khomeini among the local residents of the village, telling them about the many announcements that the Imam had made. In fact, the young Qasem Soleimani became one of the organizers and coordinators of the anti-Pahlavi regime demonstrations, protests, and general strikes in the city of Kerman in southeastern Iran. Please stay with us. Qasem Soleimani has recounted those tumultuous days of the Islamic Revolution in his personal diary, writing, "It was early 1978 and I had passed my driving test after several attempts and I was about to receive my driving license. I went to my local driving center to collect my driving license. The police officer there was named Azari Nasab and he told me to come in and sit down. Officer Azari Nasab turned to me and said, 'Your driving license is ready. You can collect it now. It has been signed by Khomeini himself.' I didn't quite get what he meant by that sarcastic remark. I was led into an empty room and two army officers entered after me and immediately started to push me around, hit me in the face and kick me. They also swore at me. I was caught in their trap and escape was impossible. After a thorough beating, I lied on the floor with a bloody nose and a bloody face. They had kicked me and punched me so badly that I was unable to move. One of the two officers then stood on my stomach and used his heavy army boots to kick my stomach so hard that it felt like all my internal organs were bleeding. I became unconscious. Despite being young and athletic and a practitioner of weightlifting and karate, I ran out of stamina and energy. I was so badly beaten, I couldn't move for 3 days. But at the end of it all, I felt a new energy surge. My fear of being beaten and tortured evaporated. And it was almost as if, with every kick and every punch I had received, the word Khomeini was etched in my mind and hacked in my soul. I became fearless and a true revolutionary. I said whatever I wanted to say, and I was afraid of no one." Mata Soleimani regarded the Islamic Revolution of 1979 as a complex and deep-rooted phenomena. He always used to say that the factor which guaranteed the success of the revolution for several decades was Islam, genuine Muhammadian Islam. It was the Iranian people's firm belief in Islam which navigated them safely through the turbulent waters and made them overcome all enemy conspiracies and plots. Soon after the fall of the Pahlavi regime and the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Qasem Soleimani joined a unit of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, the IRGC. In 1980, the 8-year imposed war on Iran started, and Qasem Soleimani and his colleagues rushed to the war front to defend the fledgling Islamic Republic and the ideals of the Islamic Revolution. They staunchly fought for their country, giving everything that they had. 8 years of sacred defense is undoubtedly one of the most important and unique chapters in Iranian history. Some of the most prominent personalities, cultural and intellectual figures of the Islamic Revolution played a part in 8 years of sacred defense. They presented to the world a special type of religious and Islamic lifestyle during the sacred defense years. Iran's soldier, Qasem Soleimani, was certainly a pioneer in the culture of sacred defense, and Soleimani played a very important role in those years of warfare. Soon after the fall of the Pahlavi regime and the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Qasem Soleimani joined a unit of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, the IRGC, in 1979. He joined the Quds training section of the IRGC headquarters in Kerman. He became an instructor at the IRGC base in Kerman. Commander Qurbani, a senior commander during the Iran-Iraq War and one of Qasem Soleimani's superior officers, recalls, "The night before the operation was due to start, and before we went to the front lines, Soleimani approached me and said, 'I must accompany my troops to the front line.' I wasn't keen on the idea and told him to substitute his second-in-command for himself. But Qasem Soleimani insisted that he wanted to accompany his forces to the front lines. And when the go-ahead for the operation was given, Soleimani and his battalion immediately attacked enemy lines and fierce fighting broke out. Qasem Soleimani's battalion managed to break through enemy lines and soon they were attacking the enemy's second line. But shortly afterwards, news of the martyrdom of the head of the battalion circulated. I dispatched several people to the front lines and told them to bring back Soleimani in any way that they could. I next met Soleimani at the Accidents and Emergency Department of Susangerd Hospital. He was lying on a bed unconscious. His right arm was badly injured by bullets and shrapnel. Some shrapnel had also entered his chest, and he was bleeding internally. I ordered an ambulance to take him to a bigger and better equipped hospital in the city of Ahwaz in southwestern Iran, where he could receive better medical treatment. About 3 weeks later, I saw him at the IRGC headquarters in Kerman. Apparently, he had been transferred from Ahwaz to a hospital in Tehran, and there they had treated the serious injuries to his right arm. But before he had time to fully recover, he decided to discharge himself from the hospital and went straight back to the front line, with his right hand hanging from a bandage to his neck. It was right then that I decided to introduce Qasem Soleimani to the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, the IRGC, Commander Mohsen Rezaei. I told Mohsen Rezaei, "Mr. Soleimani is both courageous and highly capable and can easily command a brigade." And sure enough, Mohsen Rezaei appointed Qasem Soleimani as the commanding officer of the Sar Allah Brigade. Qasem Soleimani was involved in many of the key operations of the 8-year war. Among them, he commanded a brigade of the Walfaj 8, Karbala 4, and Karbala 5 operations. He was injured twice during the war, one of them very seriously. Wisdom, intellect, and expediency were all highly visible in Qasem Soleimani. When it came to the enemy, he was really strong-headed and was not flexible. And he took a hard-line approach. It is common practice in wartime that senior commanders are usually stationed 20 to 30 kilometers from the troops that they command in the front lines. Very few senior commanders actually serve in the front line itself. But Haj Qasem Soleimani was a senior commander who always insisted on accompanying his troops in the front line. He was always there in the front line, in person, heading the operation that he commanded. He was a commanding officer and a real friend to all those who served under him. He knew and remembered the name of every single soldier, one of the 1,500 men who served under him. He knew the family circumstances of every single soldier who served under him, and when giving a lecture or presentation, he used to notice if one of his men was absent, and he always wanted to know the reason for this absence. Qasem Soleimani was more than just a commander. He was a true friend of every soldier who served under him.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.